So, now we can talk about where we are in this amazing Jewish calendar cycle. During the month of Elul, and especially the 10 days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, we reflect on how we've been living our lives. We confess our errors, ask for and grant forgiveness, as if we're preparing to face death. And on Yom Kippur, we practice dying by abstaining from life-affirming activities. And we end Yom Kippur with the celebration of our renewal. And now we're in the fifth day of Sukkot, when we are commanded to eat and sleep outside and be joyous. And in a few days, we will celebrate Simchat Torah with the continuous renewal of Torah reading. And we'll finish reading the last lines of Torah, the account of the death of Moses, and we immediately begin again with the first verses of Bereshit in the beginning. So today, I want to reflect on these particular holiday rituals and what they teach us about our experience of life, death, and renewal. As always, we're guided in our understanding of the high holidays by Rabbi Alan Liu's reflection on the journey of the soul through the holiday cycle. This is real, and you are completely unprepared. And this year, my appreciation of these Jewish wisdom practices is enriched by Thich Nhat Hanh's Guide to Buddhist Wisdom Practices, the heart of the Buddha's teaching, transforming suffering into peace, joy, and liberation. And last week, Rabbi Carol Glass's teachings on Sukkot and what it means to keep things in perspective is another inspiration for these reflections. So in the last chapter of This Is Real, Rabbi Liu describes our transition from Yom Kippur to Rosh Hashanah. He writes, "We've spent the past many weeks stripping ourselves naked, acknowledging our brokenness, allowing ourselves to see what we usually won't look at, embracing the emptiness at the core of experience, reducing our lives to a series of impulses that rise up and fall away again. And we have even let the reins of denial slip a little bit. We have relaxed our fierce determination to ward off death at any cost. We have invited ourselves to entertain the possibility that we might die. On Rosh Hashanah, it is written, we acknowledged, who will live and who will die, and by Yom Kippur, we've acknowledged that it could happen to us. So, he writes, now we sit flush with the world in a house that calls attention to the fact that it gives us no shelter. It is not really a house. It is the interrupted idea of a house, a parody of a house. According to Jewish law, this booth we must dwell in for 7 days need only have closed walls on 2.5 sides, and we have to be able to see the stars through the organic material, the leaves and branches that constitute its roofs. This is not a house. It's the bare outline of a house, and it exposes the idea of a house as an illusion. The idea of a house is that it gives us security, shelter, haven from the storm. No building of wood and stone can ever afford us protection from the disorder that is always lurking around us. No shell we put between us and the world can ever really keep us secure from it. And we know this. We never really believed in this illusion. That's why we never felt truly secure in it. The rabbis of the Talmud told this parallel. It is the usual way of human beings to feel secure and unafraid while under the shelter of their own roofs. On emerging from their homes, their sense of security is diminished, and they begin to feel fear. Israel, however, is different. While in their homes the whole year, they are apprehensive. But when Sukkot comes and they leave their homes and come under the shadow of the sukkah, their hearts are full of trust, faith, and joy, for now they are protected, not by the protection of their roofs, but by the shadow of their faith and trust in God, or, as we may say, trust in the unfolding of reality in each moment. So, how often have we come across this teaching in Buddhist practice or in modern psychological discussions of health? As long as we are putting up barricades against things we fear, or erecting barriers within that keep us from knowing the distressing things that we're trying not to think or feel, we are feeling insecure, always at risk of some unwanted intrusion from the outside or from within. How often have we heard Rumi's poem, The Guest House, at meditation retreats, reminding us that we are safe only when we can welcome and accept all the uninvited guests? And it's read so often, I usually decide not to read it, but reading it in the context of Sukkot, I just felt it had a new meaning. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes, an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. I had not previously understood this poem as a guide to the high holidays, but it does describe our month of self-reflection during Elul, which reveals to us things we don't want to see, followed by the literal welcoming of all guests into our sukkah, which is a totally transparent and open structure. The poem gives me a new understanding of the ritual of welcoming ushpizim, guests, into the sukkah. The custom of ushpizim seems to derive from the Zohar, in which there is a formula for inviting on each night of Sukkot one of our seven exalted forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, Aaron, and David. Of course, today we're encouraged to invite any people we admire, anyone who is exalted in our current estimation. But the guest house poem deepens the meaning of this ritual for me. You can't lock anyone out of a properly built sukkah. You need to welcome all the unwanted and wanted metaphoric visitors, joys, sadness, our lofty ideals, our undesirable impulses, and only when we can literally sit with them under the sukkah or in meditation or in psychotherapy, where we sit with anger, sadness, and honest acknowledgement of our impulses, only then can we feel truly safe and secure with ourselves. So yes, this being human is a guest house. As our visitors come and go and keep us forever connected and interconnected with the world. And this interconnectedness, while it's terrifying in some ways, also provides a pathway to a new perspective on life and death that is part of this process of going outside and becoming one with nature. When we see ourselves as separate, we think, well, when we die, that'll be the end of us. And yet, in one of the basic Buddhist teachings, the Heart Sutra, we're introduced to a perspective that there is no birth and no death. So it is only with the help of our wonderful teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, whose teachings live beyond his time on this earth plane, that I can begin to connect with this concept of no birth, no death, and to connect it with what we usually experience in daily life or practice in Jewish ritual. Our understanding may begin with the metaphor of the wave in the water, which has come up before in our teachings. If we think of each wave as a separate entity, it does indeed crash and die on the shore, but we all know that the wave is just a formation of water, and that water does not die, but continues in a different formation. And we too, Thich Nhat Hanh explains, are made up of lots of different elements, which miraculously compose, decompose, and eventually recompose in new forms. The molecules and atoms that form all the elements, all living and non-living things, are constantly rearranging themselves into new forms. For our most basic components, there is no death, but only redesigning into different formations like waves and water. Like waves in the water. So, of course, when we hear the Heart Sutra teaching that there is no birth and no death, we initially object. And as someone who has given birth and witnessed others giving birth, I can assure you I do think there is such a thing as birth. And on a relative level, there is, of course, birth and death and all the real feelings we have about it. As Carol taught last week, and Bill gave us such a lovely commentary on this perspective taking last week, first, we have to accept and welcome all the feelings that accompany these real-life, day-to-day experiences, which are often referred to in Buddhist practice as relative truths, as opposed to absolute truths, where from an absolute perspective, as we experience things deeply and we're loosened a bit from our constraining concepts, we may taste something of the mystical experience of non-birth and non-death. Thich Nhat Hanh explains how the notion of lifespan gets in the way of our understanding no birth, no death. We think we exist only from this point in time until this point in time, and we suffer because of that notation, of that notion. If we look deeply, we will know that we have never been born and we will never die. A wave is born and dies, is higher or lower, more or less beautiful. But you cannot apply these notions to water. When we see this, our fear will suddenly vanish. Within us, we carry the world of no birth and no death, but we never touch it because we live only with our notions, our ideas. The practice is to remove these notions and touch the ultimate dimension, nirvana, God, the worlds of no death and no birth. Because of the notions we carry, we are unable to touch it, and we live in constant fear and suffering. So, on Yom Kippur, we do embrace the notion of death, even the experience of feeling like we're dying as we don't eat and don't drink. But when we emerge into Sukkot, we reconnect with nature in a way that reminds us that we are part of a continuous cycle, an amazing system of formations that arise and pass, but whose elements are part of a continuous process. And as if an affirmation of the interconnectedness of Sukkot, Simchat Torah does not let us end our reading of the Torah, our guide to being alive as humans. We can't stop it without starting it again. The words continue seamlessly from last to first. This perspective, explained in one way by Thich Nhat Hanh and the Buddha, is also expressed in the mystical teaching, the chant that we sang at the beginning of meditation, Ein Od Milvado, there is nothing but God, everything is God. If everything is God, then from the perspective of this absolute truth, our lives are not separate from the ongoing unfolding of reality. Our lifespan is merely our time in this waveform. Most of the time, we live in the world of relative truths that births and deaths happen, and we all have to take good care of each other in very realistic ways. However, even one brief flash of touching non-birth, non-death, of touching, sensing in some way, Ein Od Milvado, or the interconnectedness we experience while in the sukkah and looking at leaves, watching the leaves sway in the wind, seeing that leaves fall. These brief moments of touching deeply the experience of interconnectedness help us to feel more fully alive and less fearful in any moment.